Chapter 5. Understanding Risks. From viruses to diets to solar flares. One sweeping, simplifying way to describe the advances of modern civilization is to see them as serial quests to reduce the risks that come from us being complex and fragile organisms trying to survive against many odds in a world abounding with dangers. The previous chapters have documented how successful we have been in this quest. Higher crop yields have improved food supply, lowered its costs, and reduced the risks of malnutrition, stunting, and childhood diseases stemming from undernutrition. Most notably, the combination of expanded food production, extensive food trade, and emergency food aid have eliminated the long-standing inevitability of recurrent famines. Better housing, more space, running and hot water, central heating, better hygiene, no single improvement being more important than more soap and the more frequent washing of hands, and better public health measures, ranging from mass-scale vaccinations to food safety oversight, have improved domestic comfort, reduced the risks of infections spread from contaminated water, cut the frequency of foodborne pathogens, and largely eliminated the dangers of carbon monoxide poisoning from wood-fired stoves. Various engineering advances and public safety measures reduced industrial and transportation accidents. Car accidents, with fatalities now in excess of 1.2 million a year, could be much more deadly without the improvements in car design and protective features, anti-intrusion bars guarding against side impacts, seat belts, airbags, brake lights at the driver's eye level, and increasingly, automatic braking and lane departure correction that have cut the risks of collision and serious injury. International treaties set down transparent rules that promote reliability and safety, such as reducing the risks of importing contaminated goods, and that make regrettable events subject to legal action, such as pursuing a parent who abducted a child to another country. And despite the impression created by media reporting, the worldwide frequency of violent conflicts and the total number of their casualties have been declining for decades. But, given the complexity of our bodies, the enormity and unpredictability of natural processes, and the impossibility of eradicating all human errors made when designing intricate machines and when operating them, it is not at all surprising that risks continue to abound in the modern world. Even people who take no particular steps to be well-informed are routinely exposed to media reports of man-made and natural dangers and the risks of diets, diseases, and quotidian activities. The first category ranges from dreaded terrorist attacks to many manifestations of chemophobia, from pesticide residues in food to carcinogens in toys or carpets, and from asbestos hidden in walls and in baby powder to the planet being ruined by anthropogenic global warming. Media reports do not miss any news of natural catastrophes, including hurricanes, tornadoes, floods, droughts, and locusts. And in the background, there are lasting worries about incurable cancers and unpredictable viruses, with recent concerns about SARS-CoV-1 and Ebola just mild previews of the anguish brought by the COVID-19 SARS-CoV-2 pandemic. The list can be easily extended by adding worries about mad cow disease, bovine spongiform encephalopathy, Salmonella or Escherichia coli, exposure to hospital microbes, nosocomial infections, non-iodizing radiation from mobile phones, cybersecurity and data theft, artificial intelligence designs or genetically engineered organisms getting out of control, the accidental launch of nuclear missiles, and a stray, unobserved asteroid hitting the planet. With such a recital, we might easily conclude that we are now exposed to more risks than ever. Or, in contrast, that the incessant and exaggerated reporting of such events or their possibilities has simply made us more aware of their existence, and that proper risk perception would provide some calming perspectives. And that is exactly what I will do in this chapter. Yes, the world is full of constant or episodic risks, but it is also replete with wrong perceptions and irrational risk appraisals. There are many reasons for these misperceptions and miscalculations, and practitioners of risk analysis have published revealing findings regarding their origins, prevalence, and endurance. But before I get back to the analyses, quantifications, and comparison of man-made and natural risks, let's start with the basics. What should we eat to promote a long life? Given the veritable minefield of modern dietary claims and counterclaims, this might seem to be an impossible or at least very difficult question to answer. How will I weigh the respective merits and demerits of diets ranging from unchecked carnivory to the purest veganism? The first one, promoted as the supposed Paleolithic diet, supplies more than a third of all food energy from meat protein. The other extends beyond never swallowing even a microgram of animal matter to never wearing leather shoes, knitted woolen sweaters, or silk blouses. The first appeals to a caricature of some of our distant evolutionary roots. The second offers the surest path to the preservation of the long-suffering biosphere because humble plants, unlike destructive domesticated animals, exert only the gentlest pressure on the environment. My approach to finding the least risky diets, those associated with life expectations above 80 years, will ignore not only all of the dubious dietary claims promoted by the media, but also, perhaps more surprisingly, scores of publications in scientific journals. In particular, those that have examined the links between diets, diseases, and longevity by following groups of various sizes and ages for shorter or longer periods of time while relying overwhelmingly on the participants' recollections of all the food they have eaten in the past. I will also disregard meta-studies of such projects. Merely listing these post-1950 publications, from the examination of coronary heart disease and saturated fat and cholesterol, to the risks of eating meat and drinking milk, would fill a small book, and a busy segment of these inquiries has been devoted to exposing the fallibility of human memory. What did you eat last week? I bet you can't remember, or at least not accurately. As well as detailing other methodological or analytical shortcomings, such that this field is rife with accusations of invalid conclusions. No wonder most people find the question of what we should eat a difficult one. These studies and their meta-studies have repeatedly failed to produce consistent, clear-cut outcomes, with new research often upending previous findings. Is there a better way out of these generations-long and still unfolding dietary conundrums? Indeed, it is quite simple. We can look at which populations live the longest and what their diets are. Eating as in Kyoto or as in Barcelona. Among the world's more than 200 nations and territories, Japan has had the highest average longevity since the early 1980s, when its combined male and female life expectancy at birth surpassed 77 years. Further gains followed, and by 2020, Japan's combined life expectancy at birth was about 84.6 years. Women live longer in all societies, and by 2020, their life expectancy in Japan was about 87.7 years, ahead of 86.2 years in second-place Spain. Average longevity is an outcome of complex and interacting genetic, lifestyle, and nutritional factors. Trying to find out to what extent it is determined by diet alone is impossible. But if there are unique features to a nation's diet, they clearly deserve a closer examination. Is there anything truly special about Japan's food consumption that would provide a ready explanation of that diet's contribution to the nation's record longevity? All of its traditional ingredients consumed in substantial quantities differ only subtly from those eaten or drunk in abundance in neighbouring Asian nations. The Chinese and Japanese consume different but nutritionally equivalent varieties of the same subspecies of rice, Oryza sativa japonica. The Chinese have traditionally coagulated their bean curd, dufu, with calcium sulfate, shigao, while the Japanese bean curd, tofu, is gelled with magnesium sulfate, nigari. But the ground legume grain is identically rich in protein. And unlike unfermented Japanese green tea, ocha, Chinese green tea, lucha, is partially fermented. These are not differences in nutritional quality, merely matters of appearance, colour, and taste. The Japanese diet has undergone an enormous transformation during the past 150 years. The traditional diet, consumed by most of the nation before 1900, was insufficient to support the population's growth potential, and it resulted in short statures among both women and men. Slow pre-Second World War improvements accelerated after the country overcame food shortages following its defeat in 1945. The consumption of milk, first introduced at school lunches to prevent malnutrition, began to rise, and white rice became abundant. Seafood supply expanded rapidly as the country built the world's largest fishing and whaling fleet. Meat became a part of common Japanese dishes, and many baked goods emerged as favourites in this traditionally non-baking culture. Higher incomes and hybridisation of tastes brought increases in mean blood cholesterol levels, blood pressure, and body weight. And yet, heart disease did not soar, and longevity increased. The latest published surveys show Japan and the US to be surprisingly close in total food energy consumed per day. In 2015 to 2016, US males consumed only 11% more, and US women not even 4% more food energy per day than their Japanese counterparts did in 2017. The two countries diverged moderately in total carbohydrate. Japan was ahead by less than 10%, and protein, with Americans less than 14% ahead, consumption, and both nations were well above the needed protein minima. But there is a major gap in terms of average fat intake, with American males consuming about 45% more and women 30% more than the Japanese. And the greatest disparity is in sugar intake. Among US adults, it is about 70% higher. When recalculated in terms of average annual differences, Americans have recently consumed about 8 kilograms more fat and 16 kilograms more sugar every year than the average adult in Japan. The widespread availability of ingredients and easy access to cooking instructions and recipes on the internet means that you too can minimize your risk of premature mortality and start eating a la Japonaise, be it the country's traditional cuisine, washoku, or its adaptations of foreign meals. Wiener schnitzel appearing as pre-sliced tonkatsu, curry and rice transformed into gooey curry raisu. But before you start breakfasting on miso soup, miso shiru, lunching on plain cold onigiri, rice balls wrapped in nori, dried seaweed, and dining on sukiyaki, meat and vegetable stew, a second opinion might be in order. What would the best European model of diet and longevity do? The Spanish women are the runners-up in the world's record life expectancy, and the country traditionally followed the so-called Mediterranean diet, with high intakes of vegetables, fruits, and whole grains complemented by beans, nuts, seeds, and olive oil. But as the average incomes in Spain rose, they rapidly changed those habits to a surprisingly high degree. Until the late 1950s, Franco's impoverished Spain continued to eat very frugally. Typical diets were dominated by starches. Annual consumption of cereals and potatoes added up to about 250 kilograms per capita, and vegetables, meat supply, carcass weight remained below 20 kilograms per capita, and actual consumption was less than 12 kilograms, of which a third was mutton and goat meat. Aceite de oliva was the most important plant oil, about 10 liters a year, and only sugar consumption, about 16 kilograms in 1960, was high in relation to other foodstuffs. Dietary changes accelerated after Spain joined the EU in 1986, and by the year 2000, it became Europe's leading carnivorous nation, after more than quintupling the average per capita supply to just above 110 kilograms per year. A subsequent slight decline cut the rate, carcass weight, to about 100 kilograms per capita in 2020, but that is still twice the Japanese mean. And with dairy products and cheeses added to fresh meat and the enormous quantity and variety of jamones, hams cured by salting and prolonged drying, it is hardly surprising that the Spanish supply of animal fat is four times the Japanese rate. Spaniards now consume almost twice the volume of plant oils as the Japanese, but their consumption of olive oil is about 25% lower than in 1960. higher incomes have only increased the traditional predilection for sugary creations, and the adoption of pop drinks did the rest. Since 1960, per capita consumption of sugar has doubled, and it is now about 40% above the Japanese level. At the same time, Spanish wine drinking has been relentlessly declining, from about 45 litres per capita in 1960 to just 11 litres by 2020. And beer has become by far the country's most consumed alcoholic drink. The way Spain now eats is substantially different from the way Japan feeds itself. And most definitely, being the continent's top carnivore, this diet hardly resembles the frugal, near-vegetarian and life-lengthening legendary Mediterranean diet. But despite a more meaty, fatty and sugary diet, and also rapidly abandoning drinking its supposedly heart-protecting wines, Spain's cardiovascular mortality has kept on declining and life expectancy has been rising. Since 1960, Spain's CVD mortality has been falling at a faster pace than the average of affluent economies, and by 2011 it was about a third lower than their mean. And since 1960, Spain has added more than 13 years to its combined male and female longevity prospect, raising it from 70 to more than 83 years by 2020. This is just 1 year less than in Japan. Is one additional year of life, and there are high chances that it might be spent in physical or mental decrepitude or a combination of both, worth replacing half of the meat you eat with tofu? Think of what you might be missing. Those paper-thin slices of jamón ibérico, that well-roasted pig, even if not done as famously as at Sobrino de Botín, a short walk south of the Plaza Mayor, where they have been preparing it for nearly 300 years. That well-cooked pulpo gallego, octopus stewed with potatoes, olive oil and paprika. These are truly existential decisions to make, but the conclusion is reasonably clear. If we were to stake longevity, accompanied by healthy and active life, solely on the prevailing diet, which, however important, is but one element of a bigger picture that includes your inherited genes and surrounding environment, then Japanese eating has a slight edge, but an only slightly inferior outcome can be had by eating as they do in Valencia. This is a vastly consequential but relatively simple risk assessment. One choice, based on convincing data, can suffice for decades to come. Other risk assessments are invariably trickier, where metrics might not be as simple as years lived. The risks of specific activities change over time. Driving in the US is now generally much safer than half a century ago, but after 50 years of driving, your skills might have deteriorated, and you pose a greater risk to yourself and others when you get behind the wheel. And if you want to know if intercontinental flying, which you might do infrequently, is riskier than downhill skiing, which you may have done for many years, you must have a rather accurate comparative yardstick. And how does one compare the risks experienced in different nations, say driving in the US, being struck by lightning while hiking in the Alps, and getting killed by an earthquake in Japan? As it turns out, we can do some remarkably accurate comparative evaluations of all of these risks. Risk perceptions and tolerances. In his pioneering 1969 analysis of risks, Chauncey Starr, at that time the Dean of the School of Engineering and Applied Science at the University of California in Los Angeles, stressed the major difference in risk tolerance between voluntary and involuntary activities. When people think that they are in control, a perception that may be incorrect but that is based on previous experiences, and hence on the belief that they can assess the likely outcome, they engage in activities. Climbing vertical rock faces without ropes, skydiving, bullfighting, whose risks of serious injury or fatality may be a thousandfold higher than the risk associated with such dreaded involuntary exposure as a terrorist attack in a large Western city. And most people have no problem engaging daily and repeatedly in activities that temporarily increase their risk by significant margins. Hundreds of millions of people drive every day, and many apparently like to do so. And an even higher risk is tolerated by an even larger number of smokers. In affluent countries, decades of education has reduced their ranks, but worldwide there are still more than 1 billion of them. In some cases, this disparity between tolerating voluntary risks and trying to avoid wrongly perceived risks of involuntary exposures becomes truly bizarre, as people refuse to have their children inoculated, voluntarily exposing them to multiple risks of preventable diseases, because they consider government requirements to protect their children, an involuntary imposition, as unacceptably risky, and have been doing so on the basis of repeatedly discredited evidence, most notably linking vaccination to a higher incidence of autism, or rumoured perils, the implanting of microchips. And the SARS-CoV-2 pandemic elevated these irrational fears to a new level. Humanity's best hope to end the pandemic was mass-scale vaccination. But long before the first vaccines were approved for distribution, large shares of the population were telling pollsters that they would not get inoculated. Widespread fear of nuclear electricity generation is yet another excellent example of risk misperception. Many people smoke and drive and eat excessively, but have reservations about living next to a nuclear power plant. And polling has shown lasting and pervasive distrust of this form of electricity generation, despite the fact that it has prevented a large number of air pollution-related deaths that would have been associated with burning fossil fuels. By 2020, nearly 3/5 of the world's electricity came from fossil fuels and just 10% from nuclear fission. And the comparison between overall risks of nuclear and fossil-fueled electricity generation does not flip even when the best estimates of all latent fatalities from the two major accidents, Chernobyl in 1985 and Fukushima in 2011, are included. Perhaps the most stunning contrast of nuclear-related risk perception is seen when comparing France and Germany. France has been deriving more than 70% of its electricity from nuclear fission since the 1980s, and nearly 60 reactors dot the country's landscape, cooled by water from many French rivers, including the Seine, Rhine, Garonne, and Loire. Yet, the longevity of the French population, second only to Spain within the EU, is the best testimony to the fact that these nuclear power plants have not been a discernible source of ill health or premature deaths. But across the Rhine, it is not only the German Greens who believe that nuclear power is an infernal invention that must be eliminated as fast as possible, but much larger portions of society too. This is why many researchers have argued that there is no objective risk waiting to be measured, because our risk perceptions are inherently subjective, dependent on our understanding of specific dangers, familiar versus new risks, and on cultural circumstances. Their psychometric studies show that specific hazards have their unique patterns of highly correlated qualities. Involuntary risks are often associated with the dread of new, uncontrollable, and unknown hazards. Voluntary hazards are more likely to be perceived as controllable and known to science. Nuclear electricity generation is widely perceived as unsafe, X-rays as tolerably risky. Feelings of dread play an outsized role in risk perception. Terrorist attacks are perhaps the best example of this differentiated tolerance, as fear takes over and drives out rational assessment readily made on the basis of incontrovertible evidence. Because of their unpredictable timing, location, and scale, terrorist attacks rank high on the psychometric scale of dread, and these fears have been intensively exploited by vastly exaggerated pseudo-analyses offered by talking heads on 24/7 news channels. During the past 2 decades, they have speculated on everything from suitcase-sized nuclear bombs detonated in mid-Manhattan to the poisoning of reservoirs used to supply drinking water to large cities and the spraying of deadly engineered viruses. Compared to such dreaded attacks, driving presents largely voluntary, high recurrent and very familiar risks, and accidental deaths involve overwhelmingly, more than 90% of cases, only one person per fatal collision. As a result, societies tolerate the global toll exceeding 1.2 million deaths a year, something they would never assent to if it were to take the form of recurrent accidents in industrial plants or collapsed structures, bridges, buildings, in or near large cities, even if the combined annual death toll of such disasters was an order of magnitude smaller, just in the hundreds of thousands of fatalities. Large differences in individual tolerance of risk are best illustrated by the fact that many individuals engage, voluntarily and repeatedly, in activities that others might consider not just too risky, but belonging all too clearly to the category of death wish. Base, fixed object jumping, is an excellent example of such an activity, as the slightest delay in opening the parachute may cost a life. A free-falling body reaches fatal velocity in a matter of seconds. And then there is risk tolerance justified by fatalistic beliefs. Diseases or accidents are predestined and inevitable, and hence it makes no sense to try enhancing one's health or preventing mishaps by appropriate personal action. Fatalistic people also underestimate risks in order to avoid the effort required to analyze them and draw practical conclusions, and because they feel totally unable to cope with them. Traffic fatalism has been particularly well studied. Fatalistic drivers underestimate dangerous driving situations, are less likely to practice defensive driving, no distractions, keeping safe trailing distance, no speeding, and are less likely to restrain their children with seatbelts or to report involvements in road accidents. Worryingly, studies in some countries found traffic fatalism prevalent among taxi drivers and pervasive among minibus drivers. There is little we can do to convert base jumpers into paragons of risk-averse behaviour or to convince many taxi drivers that their accidents are not predetermined. But we can use the best available understanding of risks, both of those in everyday life and those that are exceedingly uncommon but potentially deadly, to quantify their consequences and hence to compare their impacts. This is not an easy task, because we have to deal with such a variety of events and processes. Moreover, there is no perfect metric to do so, and there can be no universal yardstick to compare the ubiquitous risks faced daily by billions of individuals with the extraordinarily rare events that may take place just once in 100, 1,000, or even 10,000 years, but with catastrophic global consequences. In any case, that is what I will try to do. Quantifying the risks of everyday life. For older people, the danger starts even before waking up. Heart attacks, acute myocardial infarctions, are more common and more severe during the dark to light transition period. When they get up, one of the most common ways older people injure themselves is to fall. In the US, millions of accidental falls take place every year, leaving bruises or broken bones, and more than 36,000 deaths, disproportionately among those more than 70 years old, and often occurring not when walking up or downstairs but when simply losing balance or tripping over a carpet edge. And, once you make it to your kitchen, there are food-associated risks, from salmonella in improperly cooked eggs to pesticide residue in tea. This is a minuscule but for drinkers of non-organic tea everyday exposure. A morning drive may be on an icy road, or a drugged-up driver could go through a red light. Your office walls may still hide old asbestos insulation, and faulty air conditioning may spread Legionella bacteria. Your co-workers may infect you with seasonal flu, or, as happened in 2020 to 21, 2009, 1968 and 1957, with a new pandemic virus. You may have a severe allergic reaction to a nut accidentally admixed into a nut-free chocolate bar. If it is tornado season in Texas or Oklahoma, you might return from work to see your home turn into a pile of rubble. And if you live in Baltimore, you cannot remain unconcerned about the city's homicide rate that is an order of magnitude higher than in Los Angeles, the city famous for its gangs. And as hardly any generic drugs are made domestically, they come mostly from China and India, your drugstore may not fill your prescription because a contaminated batch was pulled from distribution. And detailed data on age and sex-specific death rates show how the reasons for, and hence the concerns about, getting mortally sick change as people grow older. The latest statistics show that among males in England and Wales, heart disease dominates from the early 50s to the late 70s. And for women, breast cancer becomes the most dreaded disease by their mid-30s, and it remains so until their mid-60s. Afterwards, lung cancer is the single largest cause of death among females, and dementia and Alzheimer's disease have recently displaced ischemic heart disease as the leading cause of death for both sexes over 80 years of age. Quantifying common risks seems to be a daunting enterprise. How does one compare the risks of dying due to an unusually severe seasonal influenza epidemic to the risk of a mortal injury resulting from occasional weekend kayaking or snowmobiling? Or the risk of frequent trans-Pacific flying to the risk of habitual eating of California-grown lettuce that might be repeatedly contaminated with Escherichia coli? And how do we express fatal risks? Per standard number of people, 1,000 to 1 million in an affected population? Per unit of hazardous substance, per unit of time exposure, or per unit of ambient concentration? A uniform metric able to subsume fatalities and injuries or economic losses, whose totals could differ by orders of magnitude among different societies, and chronic pain, something that remains notoriously unquantifiable, is clearly an impossible objective. But the finality of dying provides a universal, ultimate, and incontestably quantifiable numerator that can be used for comparative risk assessment. The simplest and most obvious way to make some revealing comparisons is to use a standard denominator and to compare annual frequencies of causes of death per 100,000 people. When using the US statistics, the latest published detailed breakdown is for 2017, this leads to some surprising outcomes. Homicides take almost as many lives as leukemia, 6 versus 7.2, a dual testament to the advances in treating that malignancy and to the extraordinary violence of American society. Accidental falls kill almost as many people as the dreaded pancreatic cancer, with its short post-diagnosis survival, 11.2 versus 13.5. Motor vehicle accidents take twice as many lives, and moreover much younger ones, than does diabetes, 52.2 versus 25.7. And accidental poisoning and noxious substances exact a higher death toll than does breast cancer, 19.9 versus 13.1. But these comparisons use the same denominator, 100,000 people, without taking into account the duration of exposure to a given cause of death. Homicides can and do take place in public and private and at any time of day or night, and the exposure to this risk is thus 24 hours a day, 365 days a year. But motor vehicle accidents, including those that kill pedestrians, can happen only when somebody is driving. And most Americans spend only about an hour behind the wheel every day. A more insightful metric, then, is to use the time during which people are affected by a given risk as the common denominator and do the comparisons in terms of fatalities per person per hour of exposure. That is, the time when an individual is subject, involuntarily or voluntarily, to a specific risk. This approach was introduced in 1969 by Chauncey Starr in his evaluation of social benefits and technological risks, and I still find it preferable to another general metric, that of micromorts. These units define a microprobability, a 1 in a million chance of death per specific exposure, and express it per year, per day, per surgery, per flight, or per distance travelled. And these non-uniform denominators do not make for easy across-the-board comparisons. Overall death rates per 1,000 people are well monitored worldwide, both for populations at large and for each sex by specific age group. Overall mortality depends heavily on the population's average age. In 2019, the global mean was 7.6 per 1,000, while Kenya's mortality, despite a lower standard of nutrition and healthcare, was less than half of the German rate, 5.4 versus 11.3, because Kenya's median age of just 20 years is less than half of Germany's 47 years. Data on deaths due to specific diseases are also commonly available, with cardiovascular diseases accounting for a quarter of the total in the US, 2.5 per 1,000, and cancers for a fifth, 2 out of every 1,000, as is the information on deaths due to injuries, ranging from about 1.4 for falls and 1.1 for transport accidents to 0.7 for encounters with animals and just 0.03 for accidental poisonings and natural disasters. The entire year, 8,766 hours when corrected for leap years, is the denominator overall mortality for chronic diseases and for natural disasters such as earthquakes or volcanic eruptions that can strike any time. But in order to calculate risks for such common activities as driving or flying, we have to ascertain first the totals of specific populations engaged in these activities, and then to estimate the average hours of annual exposure. The same sequence applies to quantifying the risks of dying in a hurricane or a tornado. These cyclones are not around every day of the year and do not affect the entirety of large countries. Calculating the baseline, the average population-wide or sex and age-specific risk of overall mortality, is easy. In 2019, overall mortality, crude death rate, of well-off, developed countries clustered at around 10 in 1,000, with actual rates ranging from 8.7 for North America to 10.7 in Japan and 11.1 for Europe. That annual mortality of 10 in 1,000, with 1,000 people subject to dying for 8,766 multiplied by 1,000 hours, prorates to 0.000001, or 1 multiplied by 10 to the power of minus 6 per person per hour of exposure. Cardiovascular diseases are the leading cause of mortality in all affluent countries, and they account for nearly a quarter of that total, 3 multiplied by 10 to the minus 7. Seasonal influenza carries a risk an order of magnitude lower, usually about 2 times 10 to the minus 8 and up to about 3 times 10 to the minus 8. And even in the violence-prone United States, the risk of homicide has recently been just 7 times 10 to the minus 9 per hour of exposure, half the risk of death attributable to falls, 1.4 times 10 to the minus 8. But, as already noted, the frequency of the latter kind of accidental death is highly skewed, with people over 85 years of age having a risk of 3 times 10 to the minus 7 compared to just 9 times 10 to the minus 10 for people 25 to 34 years old. To reverse the conclusion about general mortality, in affluent countries, the overall risk of natural demise amounts to 1 person among 1 million dying every hour. Every hour, 1 person among about 3 million dies of heart disease, and 1 among roughly 70 million dies of an accidental fall. Such odds are sufficiently low not to preoccupy an average citizen of any affluent country. Sex and age-specific numbers are inevitably different. While Canada's overall mortality for both sexes is 7.7 per thousand, for young, 20 to 24 years males, it is only 0.8 out of 1,000. But for men of my age, 75 to 79 years, it is 35 out of 1,000. And my group's risk is then 4 times 10 to the minus 6 per person per every hour of being alive, 4 times the rate for the population average. Before I turn to quantifying the risks of voluntary activities, I should clarify the dangers associated with hospital stays. They are unavoidable because of many conditions, and in many countries also increasingly for elective cosmetic surgeries, and high patient throughputs make it more likely that medical errors will happen. In 1999, the first study of preventable medical errors found that anywhere between 44,000 and 98,000 of them are made in the US every year. That was an uncomfortably high total, and in 2016, a new study raised it to 251,454 cases in 2013, and possibly to as many as 400,000 deaths, making it the third highest cause of US mortality in that year, behind heart disease, 611,000, and cancers, 585,000, and ahead of chronic respiratory disease, 149,000. These results, widely reported in the mass media, implied that every year 35 to 58% of all hospital deaths in the country were due to medical error. When put in this way, the implausibility of those claims become easily evident. Careless errors surely take place. Regrettable omissions do happen. But that they could add up to anywhere between just over a third and nearly three-fifths of all hospital deaths would brand modern medicine as an extraordinarily inept, if not outright criminal, endeavour. Fortunately, these high mortalities did not result from carelessness, but from data handling errors. The latest study of mortality associated with adverse effects of medical treatment, or AEMT, sets the record straight. It found 123,063 such deaths between 1990 and 2016, mostly due to surgical and perioperative errors, a decline of 21.4% to 1.15 AEMT deaths per 100,000 people. Men and women had similar rates, but states differed significantly, with California as low as 0.84 AEMT deaths per 100,000. In absolute terms, this averages to about 4,750 deaths a year, less than 2% of the lowest estimate published in 2016. Translated into a comparative risk metric, this results in about 1.2 times 10 to the minus 6 fatalities per hour of exposure, which means that any elderly male listener to this book, whose general mortality risk is between 3 times 10 to the minus 6 and 5 times 10 to the minus 6, will increase his risk of demise due to AEMT by no more than about 20 to 30% during the few days of an average stay in an American hospital, and that, I would argue, is a very encouraging risk finding. Voluntary and involuntary risks. How much do we increase these baseline risks? Risks associated with such unavoidable events as emergency operations or short hospital stays required for medical evaluations, by voluntary exposures through participating in a wide variety of more or less risky endeavours? And how much should we worry about unavoidable involuntary risk resulting from natural hazards ranging from earthquakes to floods? As already noted, these are useful categories for risk assessment, but the distinction between voluntary and involuntary exposures is not always obvious. There are clear-cut voluntary and fairly to very risky activities such as smoking or engaging in extreme sports, and obviously unavoidable involuntary risks both at an individual level, including the exceedingly low danger of being hit by a meteorite, and as collective, indeed a planet-wide experiences, the Earth colliding with an asteroid being the foremost example. But many risky exposures cannot be so easily assigned, because there is no clear dichotomy between voluntary and involuntary risks. Driving to work may be a matter of choice for a family that built a dream exurban house, but it is a matter of unavoidable necessity for millions of people in North America with its notoriously poor mass transit systems. And if a young man wants to stay in Newfoundland, there are not many choices beyond becoming a fisherman or a worker on a massive oil-producing platform, both being far more risky occupations than moving to Toronto, learning how to code, and writing apps in a glassed office far away from the rock jutting into the North Atlantic. Keeping these complications in mind, I will first explain the risks associated with driving and flying, activities that globally involve hundreds of millions of vehicle drivers and passengers, and recently more than 10 million paying flyers every day. For both activities, we must start by accurately counting the number of deaths and then deploying necessary assumptions in order to define affected populations and their aggregate time of exposure to a given risk. For driving, it is obviously time spent behind the wheel, or as a passenger. For the US, we have totals of distances travelled every year by all motor vehicles and by passenger cars. A recent grand total has been about 5.2 trillion kilometres annually. And after declining for many years, traffic fatalities have gone up slightly to about 40,000 a year. In order to estimate the time spent driving, we have to divide the distance driven by average speed, and obviously this number can be only a defensible approximation, not an accurate rate. Intercity speeds show less variation, but urban speeds tend to drop by as much as 40% during recurrent rush hours. Assuming an average combined speed of 65 kilometres per hour, about 40 miles per hour, gives us annually about 80 billion driving hours in the US. And with 40,000 fatalities, this translates exactly to 5 times 10 to the minus 7. 0.000005 fatalities per hour of exposure. neither the fact that traffic fatalities also include pedestrians and bystanders killed by vehicles, nor the deployment of other plausible average speeds, say 50 or 70 kilometers per hour, would change the order of magnitude. Driving is an order of magnitude more dangerous than flying, and during the time a person is driving, the average chance of dying goes up by about 50% compared to staying at home or tending a garden, as long as that does not include climbing a tall ladder or working with a large chainsaw. And for men of my age group, the driving risk bump is only 12% above the overall risk of dying. Driving risks in the US also show significant differences due to gender and population groups. The lifetime risk of dying in a motor vehicle accident is only 0.34% for Asian American females, 1 out of 291, but 1.75%, 1 of every 57, for Native American males. While the risk for all individuals is 0.92%, 1 out of 109. Of course, in other countries where people drive much less than Americans and Canadians, but where the accident rates are much higher, they are about twice as common in Brazil, three times as much in sub-Saharan Africa, the risks are up to an order of magnitude greater. Scheduled commercial flights, already a very low-risk activity at the end of the last century, got appreciably safer during the first two decades of the 21st century. This conclusion stands despite some disturbing recent losses, including the still unsolved and likely never to be explained disappearance of Malaysia Airlines Flight 370, somewhere over the Indian Ocean in March 2014, followed by the downing of Malaysia Airlines Flight 17 over eastern Ukraine in July 2014, and the two crashes of the new Boeing 737 MAX, Lion Air Flight 610 in the Java Sea, October 29, 2018, and Ethiopian Airlines Flight 302 near Addis Ababa on March 10, 2019. Perhaps the most revealing way to compare the airline industry's fatalities is per 100 billion passenger kilometres flown. This rate was 14.3 in 2010. It reached a record low of 0.65 in 2017, but it increased to 2.75 in 2019. Flying in 2019 was thus more than five times safer than in 2010, and more than 200 times safer than at the beginning of the jetliner era in the late 1950s. Expressing these fatalities in terms of risks per hour of exposure is fairly straightforward. The mean 2015-2019 total of accidental deaths was 292. The averages of 68 trillion passenger kilometres flown and 4.2 billion passengers mean that average passengers flew about 1,900 kilometres and spent about 2.5 hours in flight. The total of about 10.5 billion passenger hours spent aloft and 292 fatalities translates to 2.8 times 10 to the minus 8, or 0.00000028 fatalities per person per hour of flying. This is only about 3% of the general risk of mortality while aloft, and in the case of a septuagenarian male, the risk while aloft arises by a mere 1%. Any rational frequent flyer, and even more so an elderly one, should worry more about encountering unforeseen delays, running the security theatre gauntlet, enduring the tedium of long-distance flying, and coping with the debilitating effects of jet lag. At the opposite end of the voluntary risk spectrum are activities whose brief duration carries a high probability of death. None is riskier than base jumping from cliffs, towers, bridges and buildings. The most reliable study of this asking-for-it madness looked at an 11-year period of jumping from the Skjærvåg Massif in Norway, where one in every 2,317 jumps, nine in total, resulted in death, with an average exposure risk of 4 times 10 to the minus 2. 0.04. For comparison, in skydiving, a fatal accident used to take place roughly once every 100,000 jumps, but the latest US data show one fatality for every 250,000 jumps. With a typical descent lasting 5 minutes, the exposure risk is only about 5 times 10 to the minus 5. Still 50 times higher than just sitting in a chair for those 5 minutes, but it is only about one-thousandth of the risk associated with base jumping. Again, only very few people are actually aware of these specific numbers, but nearly all people, save for the risk-tolerant few, behave as if they have internalized them. In 2020 in the US, about 230 million people held a driver's license. Exposure risk behind the wheel is 5 times 10 to the minus 7 per person per hour. About 12 million were downhill skiers, 2 times 10 to the minus 7 while descending. The United States Parachuting Association has about 35,000 members, 5 times 10 to the minus 5 while aloft. The US Hang Gliding and Paragliding Association has about 3,000 members, and what they do, depending on the length of flights lasting anywhere between 20 minutes and a few hours, carries a fatality risk of 10 to the minus 4 to 10 to the minus 3. And although base jumping has been increasing in popularity, particularly in Norway and Switzerland, in the US it is still confined to a few hundred mostly male fate tempters whose risk of dying is 4 times 10 to the minus 2 during their brief falls. The strong inverse relationship between the risk and overall participation in an activity is obvious. Large numbers of people are willing to risk a dislocated shoulder or a sprained ankle while skiing downhill on a groomed run. Very few are into launching themselves into the void from precipices. Finally, a few key numbers concerning one of the most dreaded modern involuntary exposures, the risk of terrorism. Between 1995 and 2017, 3,516 people died in terrorist attacks on US soil, with 2,996 fatalities, or 85% of that total, on September 11, 2001. Countrywide individual exposure risk thus averaged 6 times 10 to the minus 11 during those 22 years, and for Manhattan, it was 2 orders of magnitude higher, increasing the risk of just being alive by 0.1%, a quantity that is too small to be meaningfully internalized. In less fortunate countries, the recent toll of terrorist attacks has been much higher. In Iraq in 2017, with more than 4,300 deaths, the risk rose to 1.3 times 10 to the minus 8, and in Afghanistan in 2018, 7,379 deaths, to 2.3 times 10 to the minus 8. But even that rate raises the basic risk of being alive by just a few percent, and it remains lower than the risk people voluntarily assume by driving, particularly in places with no lanes and ad hoc traffic rules. But correct as they are, these comparisons also show the inherent limits of dispassionate quantification. Most people commuting to work by car drive only at specific times, spend rarely more than an hour or an hour and a half per day on the road, follow familiar routes, and, save for inclement weather or an unexpected traffic jam, feel pretty much in control. In contrast, during times of peak terror, bombings or shooting attacks in Kabul or Baghdad took place at unpredictable times and intervals, in many public places, from mosques to markets, and there is no reliable way to completely avoid such threats while living in a city. As a result, the lower exposure rates to terrorist threats carry an unquantifiable accompaniment of dread, qualitatively so different from being concerned about possibly slippery roads during a morning commute. Natural hazards, less risky than they look on TV. And how do recurrent deadly natural hazards compare with just being alive and with the risks of extreme sports? Some countries are repeatedly, but not very frequently, subject to just one or two kinds of catastrophic events. Flooding and extremely strong winds in the case of the UK, while the US has to cope every year with many tornadoes and extensive flooding, frequently with hurricanes. Since the year 2000, nearly 2 hurricanes a year made a landfall, and heavy snowfalls, and its Pacific states are always at risk of experiencing a major earthquake and possible tsunami. Tornadoes kill people and destroy homes every year, and detailed historical statistics make it possible to calculate accurate exposure risks. Between 1984 and 2017, 1,994 people were killed in the 21 states with the highest frequency of these destructive cyclones. The region between North Dakota, Texas, Georgia, and Michigan, with about 120 million people. and about 80% of those deaths took place in the 6 months of the year from March to August. This translates to about 3 times 10 to the minus 9, 0.00000003 fatalities per hour of exposure, a risk that is 3 orders of magnitude lower than just living. Very few inhabitants of America's tornado-swept states are aware of this rate, but they recognize, as do people in other areas subject to recurrent natural catastrophes, that the probability of being killed by a tornado is sufficiently small, and hence the risk of continued living in such regions remains acceptable. Widely broadcast images of destruction left by powerful tornadoes make viewers living in atmospherically less violent regions wonder why people say that they will rebuild on the same spot. But such decisions are neither irrational nor recklessly risky, and because of them, millions of people continue to live in the tornado alley that extends from Texas to South Dakota. Remarkably, calculations of exposure risks to other commonly encountered natural disasters around the world converge on the same order of magnitude, 10 to the minus 9, or yield even lower rates. Again, these low average fatality exposure rates help to explain why entire countries come to terms with the ever-present risks of earthquakes. Between 1945 and 2020, Japanese earthquakes, which can affect every part of the island nation, killed about 33,000 people, more than half as a result of the March 11, 2011 Tohoku earthquake and tsunami, 15,899 deaths and 2,529 missing. But for a population that grew from 71 million in 1945 to nearly 127 million in 2020, that works out to about 5 times 10 to the minus 10. 0.00000005 fatalities per hour of exposure, 4 orders of magnitude lower than the country's overall mortality rate. Obviously, adding 0.0001 to 1 can hardly be a decisive factor that changes the overall assessment of life's risks. Floods and earthquakes in most parts of the world carry exposure risks mostly on the order of between 1 times 10 to the minus 10 and 5 times 10 to the minus 10, and the post-1960 rate for American hurricanes, potentially affecting about 50 million people in the coastal states from Texas to Maine and killing, on average, about 50 people a year, has been about 8 times 10 to the minus 11. That is a remarkably low rate, either very similar to or perhaps even lower than what most people would consider an exceptionally low natural risk, being killed by lightning. In recent years, lightning has killed fewer than 30 people a year in the US. And when assuming that the danger applies only when outdoors, averaging 4 hours a day, and during the 6 months from April to September, when about 90% of all lightning occurs, the risk equals about 1 times 10 to the minus 10, while extending the exposure period to 10 months lowers it to 7 times 10 to the minus 11, 0.00000000007. The fact that US hurricanes now present a fatality risk no greater than lightning illustrates how their toll has been reduced by satellites, advanced public warnings and evacuations. At the same time, there are reasons for concern, as both the annual worldwide frequency of natural disasters and their economic cost have been increasing. We can say this with a high degree of confidence because the world's largest reinsurance companies, whose profits and losses depend on the unpredictable occurrences of earthquakes, hurricanes, floods, and fires, have been carefully monitoring their trends for decades. Insurance is an ancient practice of providing different degrees of compensation for a variety of risks. While life insurance is based on highly predictable survival rates, insuring against unpredictable major natural hazards forces insurance companies to share the risk associated with such disasters by securing their own insurance. As a result, the world's largest reinsurance companies, Swiss Re, German Munich Re, and Hannover Rück, French SCOR, US Berkshire Hathaway, British Lloyd's, are the most assiduous students of natural catastrophes because their very existence depends on making proper calls. In order to avoid rising insured losses, they should not set their insurance premiums on the basis of outdated numbers that would underestimate future risks. Numbers of all natural catastrophes recorded by Munich Re show expected year-to-year fluctuations, but the upward trend has been unmistakable. A slow increase between 1950 and 1980, a doubling of annual frequency between 1980 and 2005, and about a 60% rise between 2005 and 2019. Overall economic losses, reflecting exceptional burdens stemming from major disasters, show even greater annual fluctuations and an even steeper rising trend. When measured in constant 2019 monies, the pre-1990 record was about $100 billion, while 2011 set an all-time record of just over $350 billion, and that total was nearly matched in 2017. Insured losses ranged mostly between 30 and 50% of total losses, with the 2017 record reaching nearly $150 billion. Until the 1980s, the rising disaster toll was mainly attributable to greater exposure, resulting from growing populations and economies, and while this trend continues, there are more people with more insured property living in disaster-prone regions. Recent decades have seen changes in natural hazards themselves. A warmer atmosphere holds more water vapor, increasing the chances of extreme precipitation. Prolonged droughts in some regions cause recurrent fires of exceptional duration and intensity. Many models now forecast further intensification of these trends, but we also know that many effective measures, from setting up exclusion zones and restoring wetlands to enacting proper building codes, can be taken to reduce their impacts. In order to get even lower risks from exposures to natural or man-made hazards, one must hunt for truly exceptional events, such as people killed by a falling meteorite or by debris from an increasing number of orbiting satellites. A report by the US National Research Council estimated that, given the quantity of space debris hitting the Earth, there should be 91 deaths a year. And that would imply about 1 times 10 to the minus 12 fatalities per hour of exposure for the global population of 7.75 billion. In reality, there have been no recorded deaths since 1900. And only recently, the first written proof of a meteorite killing a man and leaving another paralyzed was discovered among the manuscripts in the General Directorate of State Archives of the Ottoman Empire. The event took place on August 22, 1888, in what is now Sulaymaniyah in Iraq. But even if one person were killed every year, the rate would be merely 10 to the minus 14, or 8 orders of magnitude smaller, 1/100 millionth as large, than just being alive, so clearly not a reason to worry. As for the orbiting space junk, by 2019 there were some 34,000 pieces larger than 10 centimetres and more than 25 times as many pieces measuring 1 to 10 centimetres. All of these pieces break up as they re-enter the atmosphere, but even small pieces present collision risks in increasingly congested prime orbit space. Ending our civilization. When we think about rare but truly extraordinary risks that have global effects, and even more so when we contemplate catastrophic events that could severely damage or even end modern civilization, we do so on an altogether different mental plane. Those real, albeit very low, risks belong to a very different perception category. As with every event that might take place in a possibly quite distant future, we strongly discount their impact. And, as demonstrated yet again by the 2020 pandemic, we are chronically unprepared to deal even with those risks whose recurrence is measured in decades, not in centuries or millennia. Risks with truly global impacts fall into two very different categories. Relatively frequent viral pandemics that can exact a considerable toll in a matter of months or a few years, and exceedingly rare but uncommonly deadly natural catastrophes that could take place within spans as short as a few days, hours, or seconds, but whose consequences might persist not only for centuries, but for millions of years, far beyond any civilizational horizons. Should a nearby supernova explode and flood the Earth with lethal doses of radiation from cosmic rays, would we have enough time between the arrival of light and radiation to improvise shelters for most of the global population. But should this be a worry at all? A blast that would damage the Earth's ozone layer must take place less than 50 light-years away, but all of our nearby stars that might possibly explode are much farther than this. And while a gamma-ray burst could affect Earth from as far as 10,000 light-years once every 15 million years, the closest such burst on record was 1.3 billion light-years away. Clearly, this risk belongs to a largely academic category. Rather than guessing when it might happen, we should, given the frequency of such events, better ask, will any terrestrial civilization be around in, say, 150,000 or 500,000 years? Although it is a comparatively more probable event, calculating the risk of an inevitable future collision of the Earth with an asteroid is another exercise in uncertainties and in assumptions whose particularities can make an enormous difference. Encounters with asteroids or large comets happened in the past, and they will happen in the future. But do we assume that a major encounter takes place once every 100,000 years or once every 2 million years? These are relatively short spans on a geological timescale, but are far too long to be used for any revealing calculations of the likely risks per year, to say nothing about per hour of exposure. Moreover, global consequences would be very different if such an object struck the Pacific Ocean near Antarctica than if it hit Western Europe or Eastern China. In the first case, much of the damage would come from a monstrous tsunami, but, depending on the asteroid's size, there might be little dust entering the atmosphere. In the second and third cases, the impact would instantly obliterate large concentrations of the population and industrial activity and throw enormous masses of powdered rocks into the atmosphere, creating a pronounced planet-wide cooling. Americans should not worry either about supernovas or asteroids, but if they want to scare themselves by thinking about an inevitable natural catastrophe, and one that would emanate from one of the country's cherished places, then they should consider another mega-eruption of the Yellowstone supervolcano. Geological evidence shows 9 eruptions during the past 15 million years, with the last 3 known eruptions occurring 2.1 million, 1.3 million, and 640,000 years ago. Of course, the dating of just 3 events offers no basis for predicting any periodicity, but still a thought intrudes. Taking the mean interval of 730,000 between eruptions, we would have still 90,000 years of waiting left. But if the first interval was 800,000 years and the second one was 660,000 years, then a similar shortening would indicate the next span being some 520,000 years, and a new eruption would be already more than 100,000 years overdue. And whatever the interval, the consequences would depend on the magnitude of the eruption, on its duration, and on prevailing winds. The last eruption released about 1,000 cubic kilometres of volcanic ash, and the prevailing northwesterly winds would carry the plume over Wyoming, where the deepest deposits could be several metres thick, Utah and Colorado, and onto the Great Plains, affecting states from South Dakota to Texas, and burying some of the country's most productive agricultural land under 10 to 50 centimetres of ash. The combination of advance warning, due to constant seismic monitoring, and a weaker, prolonged eruption might make large-scale evacuation possible, and the loss of housing, infrastructure, and cultivable land would then be far greater than any immediate casualties. A thin covering of volcanic ash could be ploughed into the soil and actually improve its fertility, but thicker layers would be unmanageable, and they would pose additional dangers once dislodged by rains and snowmelt, resulting in silting and flooding and creating problems for decades to come. Perhaps the best example of a natural risk that would not directly kill anybody, but that would cause enormous planet-wide disruptions resulting in a large number of indirect casualties, is the possibility of a catastrophic geomagnetic storm caused by a coronal mass ejection. The corona is the outermost layer of the Sun's atmosphere. It can be seen without special instruments only during a total solar eclipse and is, paradoxically, hundreds of times hotter than the Sun's surface. Coronal mass ejections are enormous, billions of tons, expulsions of explosively accelerated material that carry an embedded magnetic field whose strength greatly surpasses that of background solar wind and the interplanetary magnetic field. Coronal ejections begin with the twisting and reconfiguration of the magnetic field in the layer's lower part. They produce solar flares and can travel, expanding as they advance, at speeds as slow as less than 250 kilometers per second, arriving at the Earth in nearly 7 days, and as fast as almost 3,000 kilometers per second, reaching the Earth in as little as 15 hours. The largest known coronal mass ejection began on the morning of September 1, 1859, while Richard Carrington, a British astronomer, was observing and drawing a large solar sunspot that emitted a sizable kidney-shaped white flare. That was nearly 2 decades before the first telephones, 1877, and more than 2 decades before the first centralized commercial generation of electricity, in 1882, and hence the notable effects were only intense auroras and disruptions of the newly expanding telegraph network whose laying began in the 1840s. Wires were sparking, messaging was interrupted or continued in bizarrely truncated ways, operators got electric shocks, some fires started accidentally. Some of the subsequent strongest events took place on October the 31st to November the 1st, 1903, and May the 13th to the 15th, 1921, when the extent of both wired telephone links and electricity grids was still fairly limited even in Europe and North America, and very sparse elsewhere. But we got a preview of what a substantial coronal mass ejection could do today in March 1989, when a much smaller and non-Carrington event knocked out Quebec's entire power grid, serving 6 million people for 9 hours. More than 3 decades later, we've become much more vulnerable. Just think of everything electronic, from mobile phones to email to international banking, and about GPS-guided navigation on every vessel and airplane, and now also on tens of millions of cars. We would find out before it hits. Our constant surveillance of the sun's activity would instantly detect any mass ejection and provide at least 12 to 15 hours of pre-strike warning. But only when the ejection reaches the point where we have stationed the Solar and Heliospheric Observatory, or SOHO, about 1.5 million kilometres away from the Earth, could we gauge its intensity. And by then, the time to react would be reduced to less than an hour, perhaps even to just 15 minutes. Even limited damage would mean hours or days of disrupted communications and grid operations, and a massive geomagnetic storm would sever all of these links on a global scale, leaving us without electricity, without information, without transportation, without the ability to make credit card payments or to withdraw money from banks. What would we do if the complete restoration of all these vital but severely crippled infrastructures took years, perhaps even a decade, to accomplish? Estimates of global damage differ by an order of magnitude, from $2 trillion to $20 trillion. But that refers only to expenditures, not to the value of lives lost during prolonged spells without communication, lights, air conditioning, hospital equipment, refrigeration, and industrial production, and hence also without adequate inputs into crop cultivation. There is some good news. A 2012 study estimated a 12% probability of another Carrington event during the coming 10 years, or a 1 in 8 chance, and it emphasized that the rarity of these extreme events makes their rate occurrence difficult to estimate, and prediction of a specific future event is virtually impossible. Given this uncertainty, it is not surprising that in 2019, a group of scientists in Barcelona calculated the risk to be no greater than 0.46 to 1.88% during the 2020s, and hence even the highest rate would mean odds of 1 in 53, a considerably more comforting probability. And in 2020, a Carnegie Mellon group offered an even lower estimate, putting a decadal 10-year probability of between 1% and 9% for an event of at least the size of the large 2012 event, and between 0.02% and 1.6% for the size of the 1859 Carrington event. While many experts are well aware of these odds and of the enormity of the potential consequences, this is clearly one of those risks, much like a pandemic, for which we cannot ever be adequately prepared. We just have to hope that the next massive coronal ejection event will not equal or surpass the Carrington event. While this may not be what the world wants to hear at this time, it is an unfortunate truth that viral pandemics are guaranteed to reappear with relatively high frequency, and although sharing inevitable commonalities, they are unpredictably specific in their impacts. In early 2020, the world had about a billion people older than 62 years, and they had all lived through three viral pandemics in a single lifetime. 1957 to 1959, H2N2, 1968 to 1970, H3N2, and 2009, H1N1. The best reconstruction of the total mortality for the 1957 to 1959 pandemic was 38 out of 100,000, 1.1 million deaths, global population 2.87 billion. The 1968 to 1970 pandemic had a mortality of 28 in 100,000, 1 million deaths, global population 3.55 billion. While the 2009 event had low virulence and mortality no higher than 3 out of every 100,000, about 200,000 deaths, global population 6.87 billion. Arrival of the next event was just a matter of time. But as already noted, we are never prepared for these relatively low-frequency threats. The World Economic Forum's ranking of top global risks, prepared annually between 2007 and 2015, led with asset price collapse, financial crisis, and major systemic financial failure 8 times, obvious echoes of 2008, and water crises once, while pandemic threat did not appear among the top 3 risks even once. So much for the collective foresight of global decision makers. And when COVID-19, caused by SARS-CoV-2, arrived, the World Health Organization waited until March the 11th, 2020, to proclaim a global pandemic, and its early advice, echoed by many governments, was against suspending international flights and against wearing masks. Obviously, we will be able to quantify the total COVID-19 mortality only after this latest pandemic ends. Meanwhile, the best way to assess the recurrent pandemic burden is to compare it to global seasonal influenza-associated respiratory mortality. The most detailed assessment for the years 2002 to 2011 found a mean of 389,000 deaths, ranging between 294,000 and 518,000 after excluding the 2009 pandemic season. This means that seasonal influenza accounts for about 2% of all annual respiratory deaths, and that its mortality rate averages 6 out of every 100,000 or 15 to 20% of the death rates recorded in the two late 20th century pandemics, 1957 to 1959, 1968 to 1970. Inversely stated, the first pandemic exacted a more than 6 times higher and the second one a nearly 5 times higher relative death toll than seasonal influenza. Moreover, there is an important difference in age-specific mortality. Seasonal flu mortality is, almost without exception, highly skewed toward old age, with 67% of all deaths among people over 65. In contrast, the infamous second wave of the 1918 pandemic disproportionately targeted people in their 30s. The 1957 to 1959 pandemic had a U-shaped mortality frequency, disproportionately affecting ages 0 to 4 and 60 plus. While COVID-19 mortality has been, much like seasonal influenza, highly concentrated in the 65-plus cohort, especially among those with significant comorbidities, and it has left children remarkably unaffected. We know that many excess deaths among older people cannot be prevented. That is a part of the price we must pay for our very successful efforts to extend life expectancy, in many affluent countries, by more than 15 years since the 1950s. A death certificate may say COVID-19 or viral pneumonia, but that is just the proximate label. The real cause is that most of us have not been designed to be without underlying health problems as we keep pushing the limits of life expectancy. Provisional COVID-19 data from the CDC make that clear. During the week of the peak US COVID-19 mortality ending on April 18, 2020, People over 65 years of age accounted for 81% of all deaths, and those younger than 35 years for a mere 0.1%. This situation is quite different from the 1918 to 1920 pandemic, when as many as 50 million people died. We now know that most of those deaths were due to bacterial pneumonia. Some 80% of cultures taken from preserved lung tissue samples contained bacteria causing secondary lung infection. And at that time, nearly a quarter century before the availability of antibiotics, we had no treatment for that condition. Moreover, people with tuberculosis were more likely than others to die of influenza, and this link also helps to explain the 1918 to 1920 pandemic's unusual middle-age mortality, as well as its clear maleness, due to the differential incidence of tuberculosis. Because tuberculosis has been essentially eradicated in all affluent countries, and because pneumonia is treatable with antibiotics, we can avoid the repetition of high mortalities. But even with our annual influenza vaccination drives, we cannot prevent significant seasonal mortality, and the survival of the oldest cohorts will be challenged every time there is a global pandemic. This is a largely self-inflicted risk, the obverse of enjoying longer life expectancy, and we can minimize it by isolating the most vulnerable individuals and by developing better vaccines, but we cannot eliminate it. Some lasting attitudes. Where risk is concerned, many truisms seem to be permanent. As individuals, we can exercise some control. Many people do not find it difficult to abstain from smoking, consuming alcohol and drugs, and prefer to stay home rather than sharing a cruise ship with 5,000 passengers and 3,000 crew in the midst of a coronavirus or norovirus outbreak. Others crave all of this. And it is astonishing how many people do not reduce even the most easily and inexpensively reducible risks. Always wearing a seatbelt, never speeding, being a defensive driver, and installing smoke, carbon monoxide, and natural gas sensors in dwellings are no-cost or very low-cost ways to reduce the risks of driving and of living in structures heated by the combustion of fossil fuels. Moreover, most people and most governments find it difficult to deal properly with low probability but high impact, high loss events. Buying basic house insurance is one thing. Often it is mandatory. Investing in earthquake-resistant structures, be it as individuals or as societies, to minimize the impact of what is likely to be a once-in-a-century event is quite another matter. California has a subsidized seismic retrofit program for pre-1980 houses. Bolting or bolting and bracing the house to its foundation in compliance with 2016 building code, but most jurisdictions that face similar seismic risks do not. But it is difficult, if not impossible, to avoid many exposures because, as already noted, in some cases there is no clear dichotomy between voluntary and involuntary risks. And most risks are beyond our control. We cannot choose our parents and hence avoid a genetic predisposition to a large number of common and rare diseases, including some cancers, diabetes, cardiovascular problems, asthma, and several autosomal recessive disorders, including cystic fibrosis, sickle cell anemia, and Tay-Sachs disease. In order to greatly reduce the risks of all local or regional natural disasters, we would have to eliminate large areas of the planet, above all those subject to recurrent mega-earthquakes and volcanic eruptions, the Pacific Ring of Fire, destructive cyclonic winds, and extensive flooding as places of human habitation. Because that is clearly impossible on an increasingly crowded planet, the only way to improve the odds of survival under those conditions is to take precautions. Earthquake-proof, steel-reinforced buildings will not bury people as surrounding structures collapse. Tornado shelters will save families so they can rebuild their leveled homes and put in place effective early warning systems and mass-scale evacuation plans to reduce the loss of life caused by cyclones, floods, and volcanic eruptions. While these measures could potentially save not just hundreds but hundreds of thousands of lives, we have limited defences or are entirely powerless against many large-scale catastrophes ranging from massive earthquake-triggered tsunami to mega-volcanic eruptions, and from prolonged regional droughts to the Earth's encounters with asteroids or comets. Another set of truisms applies to our risk assessment. We habitually underestimate voluntary, familiar risks while we repeatedly exaggerate involuntary, unfamiliar exposures. We constantly overestimate the risks stemming from recent shocking experiences and underestimate the risk of events once they recede in our collective and institutional memory. As I already noted, about 1 billion people have lived through 3 pandemics. But when COVID-19 struck, references were made overwhelmingly to the 1918 episode, as the 3 more recent but less deadly pandemics, unlike the widely remembered fear of polio during the 1950s or AIDS in the 1980s, have left no or only the most superficial impressions. There are obvious explanations for this amnesia. The 2009 pandemic was essentially undistinguishable from a seasonal influenza. And neither in 1957 to 1959, nor in 1968 to 1970, did we resort to near complete national or continental lockdowns. Inflation-adjusted statistics of global and US economic product show no drastic reversal of long-term growth rates during either of the 2 late 20th century pandemics. Moreover, the latter episode coincided with a significant expansion of international air travel. The first wide-body jetliner, the Boeing 747, flew for the first time in 1969. And, perhaps most importantly, we had no 24/7 cable TV news with its morbid attachment to announcing running death counts. No internet rife with ridiculous claims about causes and cures and with conspiracy theories. And hence no ahistorical but hysterical ways of modern news diffusion. As COVID-19 demonstrated yet again, and on scales that must have surprised even those who do not expect any good news, we are repeatedly caught ill-prepared for dealing with recurrent high-impact but relatively low-frequency risks, such as viral pandemics that take place once in a decade, once in a generation, or once in a century. How would we then cope, all reports and analyses aside, with another Carrington event? Or with an asteroid hitting the ocean near the Azores and causing a massive circum-Atlantic tsunami of the same magnitude as the one caused by the 2011 Tohoku earthquake, that is, up to 40 metres high and travelling up to 10 kilometres inland. And the lessons we derive in the aftermath of major catastrophic events are decidedly not rational. We exaggerate the probability of their recurrence, and we resent any reminders that, setting the shock aside, their actual human and economic impact has been comparable to the consequences of many risks whose cumulative toll does not raise any extraordinary concerns. As a result, fear of another spectacular terrorist attack led the US to take extraordinary steps to prevent it. These included multi-trillion-dollar wars in Afghanistan and Iraq, fulfilling Osama bin Laden's wish to draw the country into stunningly asymmetrical conflicts that would erode its strength in the long run. Public reaction to risks is guided more by a dread of what is unfamiliar, unknown, or poorly understood than by any comparative appraisal of actual consequences. When these strong emotional reactions are involved, people focus excessively on the possibility of a dreaded outcome. Death by a terrorist attack or by a viral pandemic, rather than trying to keep in mind the probability of such an outcome taking place. Terrorists have always exploited this reality, forcing governments to take extraordinarily costly steps to prevent further attacks while repeatedly neglecting to take measures that could have saved more lives at a much lower cost per averted fatality. There is no better illustration of neglected low-cost measures to save lives than the American attitude to gun violence. Not even the most shocking iterations of familiar, all too well-known mass murders, I always think first of the 26 people, including 20, 6 and 7-year-old children, shot in 2012 in Newtown, Connecticut, have been able to change the laws. And during the second decade of the 21st century, about 125,000 Americans were killed by guns, the total for homicides excluding suicides. That is the equivalent of the population of Topeka, Kansas, or Athens, Georgia, or Simi Valley, California, or of Göttingen in Germany. In contrast, 170 Americans died in all terrorist attacks in the US during the second decade of the 21st century. A difference of nearly three orders of magnitude. When we compare this to motor vehicle accidents, the toll is even more unevenly distributed. As we heard earlier, compared to Asian American females, Native American men are about five times more likely to die in their cars, but African American males are about 30 times more likely to be killed by firearms. Do I have a helpful parting insight? Perhaps, as long as we recognize these fundamental realities. Asking for a risk-free existence is to ask for something quite impossible, while the quest for minimizing risks remains the leading motivation of human progress.